and I like to wake up to On the Tracks with Jen LaFranc on CJSF 90.1 FM. That is if I have to get up early.
That's perfect.
It was a mess.
This is Bird Note. Birders in cities sometimes joke that they mostly see pigeons. But if you're waiting for a train in San Francisco, you might also see something unusual. A big bird with a serious job. His name? Pac-Man.
I got Pac-Man about 7 years ago. He's a captive-bred Harris hawk.
Vahe Alaverdian of Falcon Force, along with Pac-Man, have partnered with San Francisco area transit authorities to deter pigeons from El Cerrito del Norte station, where the situation had gotten dire.
When we first started, they were sitting on the signs, they're sitting on the concrete ledges, and their droppings are all dripping down, and it's a huge health hazard, inhaling pigeon droppings.
This form of pest management involves having a trained bird of prey fly around the area to frighten, not trap or kill. Pigeons have a homing sense and might not wise up to trapping, while poison can have ripple effects on everything from local pets to plants and wildlife.
There's no euthanization in this process. We're completely a sustainable pest management. It's a predator-prey relationship, and the prey species have no choice but to take off and find refuge somewhere else.
Hawks like Pac-Man have to be captive-bred, and they start training at 16 to 20 weeks old. They spend 2 weeks training, then keep practicing throughout their lives. Pac-Man has a close companionship with his trainers.
It's a beautiful symbiotic relationship that we have going with these raptors. The positive impact of it speaks for itself, and it's a beautiful thing. What can I say?
For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.
In the U.S., we are in an era of deindustrialization. Deindustrialization is not a failure. It actually succeeded. It did not lead to the rise of incarceration or not in a kind of one-to-one situation. I want to give some examples of the political economy of not incarceration, but decarceration. What does it look like now? The treatment industrial complex. This is where we're now. We're not just in the institutional industrial complex. We're not just in the prison industrial complex. I think we're in the treatment industrial complex.
That's Liat Ben-Moshe, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Liat Ben-Moshe on deinstitutionalization. At 11 years old, Lois Curtis became an outpatient at Georgia Regional Hospital for her cognitive and developmental disabilities. She wound up being confined and sedated in mental institutions until she was 27, when Atlanta's Legal Aid Society sued Georgia's Human Services Commissioner George Olmsted. The case of Olmsted versus Lois Curtis went all the way to the Supreme Court, and in 1999, Lois Curtis won in a 6-3 decision. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote, "Confinement in an institution severely diminishes the everyday life activities of individuals, including family relations, social contacts, work options, economic independence, educational advancement, and cultural enrichment," unquote. The case has been called the Brown versus Board of Education for Disability Rights. To talk about deinstitutionalization and abolition is Liat Ben-Moshe. A disability scholar, she teaches criminology, law, and justice at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She's the author of Decarcerating Disability, Deinstitutionalization, and Prison Abolition. She spoke at the Socialism 2022 conference in Chicago. And now, Liat Ben-Moshe.
All right, so first of all, I thought I would start very basic. And again, apologies for those that this is familiar to. But there's various ways to understand disability and madness, and I want to be very clear when I say disability and madness what that means. So first of all, the common understanding of disability is that it's medical, it's something that the doctor prescribed, something that gets you like disability benefits, something that can be fixed or should be fixed, something that should be treated, reduced. It's a lack of an ability, it's some kind of a deficit, and it's definitely an individual matter, right? Like, what's your disability? How did you become disabled? And so on. But the way that we understand disability in disability studies, med studies, people who are part of disability cultures, part of med pride, we understand disability as something that's socially constructed. So it's something that derives its meaning from historical, cultural, political, and economic structures. It's not something that's inherent in people's bodies and minds. Nobody has a disability. Really important to say, nobody does. The disability comes from interaction with the environment. People have impairments, which are also, by the way, not necessarily deficit-driven and all that. But people are disabled by environment, whether the environment is attitudinal, economic, physical environments, and so on. And so people are disabled by social circumstances. Which, by the way, it's really important to say that the state defines disability. The state defines disability often very loosely to marginalized people, but then very rigidly if you ask for resources, right? This is just one example. You can see how disability defined. The person is still exactly the same, has the same impairment or has the same mental difference and so on. But the way that we define disability changes over time and space. I think a lot of you know this, but also disability and madness are an identity, and they have a culture, and they're a political identity, and I think it's very important to say this. It's a political identity. Now, not everybody that's disabled or deaf, deaf with a capital D, or mad as in crazy, not just angry, not everybody identifies or is politicized as disabled. I mean, I was disabled for a really long time before I was politicized as disabled. And I think that that's also by design, like any other identity and consciousness. You know, not everybody's a feminist, not everybody is a leftist, and so on. And I think that, again, there's a lot of barriers to identification with disability and to understanding disability culture. So why should you think of yourself as disabled, or why should people kind of politicize themselves if they are disabled, but not necessarily, you know, they shy away from that as a categorization or identity? And I think a lot of us think about disability as, there's a lot of oppression in relation to that, but it's also generative, it's productive, it's a way to view the world. It produces knowledge and produces particular ways of resistance. But also, of course, it's a source of both pride and oppression. And I wanted to read to you a definition of ableism that I'm going to kind of build on. This is from T.L. Lewis. And this definition really is built with disabled people of color kind of coalitionally. This is a quote. Ableism is a system of assigning value to people's bodies and minds based on societally constructed ideas of normalcy, productivity, desirability, intelligence, excellence, and fitness. And at the end of the definition, which is much longer, TL says, you do not have to be disabled to experience ableism. This is not to say we're all disabled. Please don't say that. It's not true. And also, we all experience ableism. Also, not necessarily true. We can all experience ableism, but we don't experience it equally, just like we all not experience sexism equally and so on. There's like a power differential here. But what I wanted to really highlight here is that productivity, desirability, intelligence, excellence, fitness, they all are also related to the construction of, again, to labor extraction and so on. And a lot of these things are also built on, of course, colonialism and anti-blackness and so on. So What I want to talk about today is a particular form of resistance to incarceration, a particular form of abolition that comes from the knowledge of mad and disabled people, and that is deinstitutionalization, more kind of specifically. I just wanted to say that this also comes from an understanding of disability justice, and disability justice is not the combination of those two words, disability and justice. Disability justice is a particular framework. It's a particular framework that comes from the lived experience of disabled people of color, of queers with disabilities, trans and gender nonconforming people with disabilities, indigenous people with disabilities, and so on. It's a framework that emphasizes things like intersectionality, cross-movement solidarity, and is a very strong anti-capitalist politic at its heart. So it's not something that's kind of added to it. This is what disability justice means. People who don't know what it is, you should look into Sin's invalid definition of disability justice. The thing that's really important for me to say that here is that disability justice brings to our analysis of incarceration an understanding that incarceration happens in more than prisons and jails. Incarceration is a process that also happens in nursing home. It happens in residential facilities for people with intellectual disabilities. It happens in psychiatric hospitals. And this is not to say that psychiatric hospitals are like prisons, but they are all carceral spaces. They're different, but they're all carceral spaces. It's also to say that medicalization is another conduit to both criminalization and to incarceration. And to say that the carceral state and the therapeutic state are incredibly tied together. And I hope you'll see that throughout the talk. So what I bring to this, and then I'll just give you kind of the rest of the time is like the example. What I bring to this is what I called a CRIP, C-R-I-P, CRIP or Mad of Color Critique of Incarceration and Abolition. And what I mean by, CRIP is a reclaimed term by people with disabilities. MAD is a reclaimed term, just like queer is a reclaimed term. And what this CRIP or MAD of Color Critique does is that it's not just about people who identify or are even politicized as disabled people of color who are caught up in the system of policing and incarceration. It's also about centering the experiences of disablement and ableism in criminal, racial, and social justice movements. And here I want to pause and say that ableism, labor extraction, carcerality, policing were and are constructed on anti-blackness and on colonialism, even though they don't only operate on the bodies of people of color. And this is why this is a CRIP or MAD of color critique. It's bigger, of course, than particular populations, but it's definitely something that was constructed on anti-blackness, ableism, and colonialism. Again, my example is deinstitutionalization as a knowledge of resistance, deinstitutionalization as abolition. And the reason why I think this is really important, and this is the kind of quote-unquote cultural competency that I want to bring to you today, the cultural competency of mad and disabled people's knowledge, is that when we, a lot of us who are abolitionists, talk about abolition, people say it could never happen, or it can't happen now, or if it happens, it will happen in like Sweden or Norway. People always say Norway, Sweden. But surely not in the U.S., right? Surely not now, not in the system that we have now, capitalism and all that. Racism, but it already happened. Spoiler. So abolition, this is like my whole point, one of my points for today, abolition already happened. And it happened in the form of the closure of large state institutions for people who are disabled. So I define deinstitutionalization in three ways. One is the transition of people with psychiatric or intellectual or developmental or other disabilities from state institution and hospitals into community living, right? Where did people end up? It's also the closure of these facilities, right? So abolition is about building, absolutely, but it's also about shutting it down. And this is, you know, part of the definition of deinstitutionalization. But what I add to that is that deinstitutionalization is not just a process, not just something that happened. It's a logic, it's a framework, it's a movement. But instead of learning from the lessons of deinstitutionalization for abolition, it is often blamed for the rise in incarceration. In a lot of my work, I try to, you know, push against that. Just to say very briefly, the deinstitutionalization was not the culprit in the rise of incarceration and the crisis of mental health in prison. Again, spoiler alert, the crisis of mental health in prison happens because of prison. And people who are, quote unquote, homeless or housing insecure, and, you know, we know this kind of like revolving door story, right? Like people exited psychiatric institution, they went on, you know, on the streets, and then they ended up in prisons and in jails. This is not an accurate story of how, first of all, deinstitutionalization happened. And secondly, it blames deinstitutionalization for really big structural issues, like the complete annihilation of affordable, accessible housing at exactly the same time that money started going to corrections. This is why we see a rise in incarceration. This is why we see a decimation of the welfare state, because those happened exactly at the same time. What we call Reaganomics and later on neoliberalism, this is what we're talking about. So blaming deinstitutionalization for that also diverts attention from this basically state abandonment, as Ruthie Gilmore calls it. By painting deinstitutionalization as the culprit, it also leaves the disabling effect of incarceration itself intact. Like, we don't critique the fact that the reason why there's so many disabled and crazy people who experience mental health crisis in prison is because of prison. It's because of jail. It's because of incarceration itself. It's because of trauma. It's because of things like strip searches, which are nothing but basically sexual assault that happened to people day in and day out. I could give more examples, but I don't want to trigger people. But prisons, jails, very disabling, very maddening. And if we blame deinstitutionalization, we don't actually get to the root of the problem here. Well, let me move on to like my kind of second example here. So in 2012, this is for people who are Chicago, people who might remember this. In 2012, the governor of Illinois at the time, Pat Quinn, announced the closure of a variety of carceral facilities. So this was the fruits of fighting for deinstitutionalization in the state of Illinois. He announced he's going to close 2 developmental centers, psych hospitals, 2 juvenile correction facilities, women's prisons, and TAMS, the only supermax prison in Illinois. Although this was driven by a larger policy, the plan to close down these facilities also came as a result of really targeted activism, so clap yourself in the room if you were a part of that. One of the issues was, though, that a lot of the people who were part of this organizing didn't really kind of talk to each other. So deinstitutionalization activists and people who do anti-prison work often don't talk to each other. So one of the examples that I want to bring to you is the example of fighting against this anti-closure arguments and fighting for it together. Who do you think resists, or who do you know if you were a part of that struggle? Who resists the closure of carceral facilities like prisons and psychiatric hospitals? Who's against it?
Guards, unions.
Experts. Politicians with special interests. Fascists, police. Oh, insurance companies. Pharmaceuticals, some mental health providers. Great, so these are the people, but great, I mean awful, but these are the kind of main people, and those are people that resist both the closure of prisons and disability institutions. It's people who have kind of an economic interest in it. So it's unions, workers, people with economic stake, politicians. In the arena of disability, unfortunately, it's also parents. Parents for people with disabilities, especially intellectual disabilities, some of them are very much against the closure of institutions. I'll get to that a little bit later. There's a lot of differences between prisons and institutions, but when you go to rallies against closure, which I have, of these various carceral facilities, the picture is very similar. It's people usually mobilized by the union, and they have signs that say something like, save blah, blah, blah facility. you know, something about jobs, something about safety always, something about safety or something about danger. And the safety in disability arenas is often the safety of the people inside, right? Like they will not be safe on the outside. If this institution closes, they will die on the streets or they will die in whatever the community. But in prison, it's usually the safety of the people on the outside, right? Like we can't release dangerous people. It's also about the safety of the workers often. There's also a lot of discourse around choice in home, like especially in the disability arena, don't close my home. And often the place is called something, something home, like nursing home or convalescent home and so on. This issue of closure is a lot of around notions of choice, notions of home, notions of labor, and a lot, of course, about the political economy of incarceration itself, because institutions and prisons are seen as an engine of economic growth. They're seen as sites of employment, which is why there's a lot of resistance from union, of course, both AFSCME, AFSCME, and the Police and Prison Officer Union. And, you know, in that regard, James Kilgore, who's a longtime abolitionist and formerly incarcerated activist, he asks whether or not the task of a union is to represent the interests of the members or the working class more generally. And I think this is a very big question for guard unions and unions in disability institutions as well. So, of course, despite the opportunity to create coalition building between labor movements, disability rights movement, prison, it's often the case that union represent one of the staunchest critiques against abolition or closure of prisons and institutions. And in relation to deinstitutionalization, for example, AFSCME, I'm sure you all know, it stands for the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employee Union. In the 70s, they were really big against deinstitutionalization, and they still are. And they wrote these reports and got ads in the radio. Remember the radio? Yeah, the thing before Spotify. Yeah, you know, really, like, they took up space and time and money to show how deinstitutionalization means dumping people in the streets and how people are going to end up, like, in jails. Remember what I said earlier about this kind of, like, false narrative about blaming deinstitutionalization? It started... You know, it didn't start, but it was spread by stuff like this, so just to kind of give you a heads up. But moving on more like to today, the interest to keep these places open is, of course, economical, but it's also often couched in terms of the best interests of the people, especially in disability arena, where the impetus is not just to work, but the impetus or what workers are told in these spaces is that they also need to care. Right? These are called, you know, care facilities. And so it's really important to also think about the effective, with an A, the effective economy of care, not just the kind of political economy of care. I don't have a lot of time to get into it today, but a lot of people write about the effective economies of care. And the reason why I'm saying effective with an A is because it's about eliciting these, you know, kind of emotional registrars, and particularly, you know, thinking about who does the caring. So in order to understand the resistance to closure of carceral places, it's important to understand the differences and similarities between employees who work in these spaces. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics for Illinois, just as an example, correctional officers make an average of $27 an hour, while home health aides, psychiatric aides, nursing assistants, orderlies make between $11 and $14 an hour. So this is not the same. The stakes are not the same in these two facilities. The benefit for keeping institutions and prisons open is, of course, economic, but there's a lot of difference, especially in terms of race, ethnicity, and gender, as well as pay rate in terms of employees. In addition, the discussion about unions and their resistance to closure of carceral spaces often paints the working class in very masculine terms. You know, we've seen in our heads prison guards, union leaders, and although that is not true to all carceral facilities, if we add disability institutions into the mix. It's of course true that in penal facilities, these are mostly white and masculine, even if the job is held by women, the jobs are still masculine jobs. The case in disability settings today is almost the mirror image of that, because most workers are women and of color, a lot of migrant workers, and the job is very feminine because you're supposed to care, right? So this is a nurturing kind of job. My point is we have to think coalitionally about these spaces, but we have to understand the differences as organizers. When we talk about the union resistance, who is the union? What do they represent? And what is the workers also beyond the union? What is the workers, because the unions don't always represent the workers, who are the workers in these facilities? And especially with deinstitutionalization, a lot of disability support staff now works primarily in the private sectors for companies that hire them to work directly in the homes of disabled people. So the question for unions and to workers who care is how to respond to the changing economic and social realities of deinstitutionalization, for example, in ways that get their economic and emotional needs met without holding on to either defunct industries or any industry that's really morally bankrupt and warehouses people for care or profit or both. And in this case, it doesn't matter if it's care or profit or both. And the other thing I want to say is that alternatives to incarceration and useful home care responses also have to be feminist, because the people who do this care work are feminized, are women. People who do this care work now for people with disabilities are often family members of people with disabilities. And I'm sure you can understand that it's mostly either mothers or siblings that do the care work and, of course, are not paid to do that as care work goes. I wanted to end with an example and then move to another, and then move towards like more conclusionary take-home lessons. In 2012, when the governor of Illinois announced this potential closure that I was describing earlier, he also talked about the closure of TAMS, the Supermax prison in Illinois. And at that time, mothers of people who were incarcerated in TAMS marched to AFSCME quarters in Chicago carrying signs stating, "I am a mom, and my son is not a paycheck." These signs alluded, of course, to placards held by sanitation workers, black men who worked in Memphis in 1968, which is the last protest Martin Luther King Jr. participated in that said, right, I mean, they're saying, "I am a mom." Those placards said, "I am a man." This was an attempt to utilize the trope of motherhood to bring to light another, quote unquote, the civil rights issue of our time, which is mass incarceration and its relation to racism and to capitalism. My son is not a paycheck. By the powerful use of these gendered dynamics of motherhood, the protesters tried to show AFSCME, as the guards union, that it was on the wrong side of history. But in the institutional arena, this is much more complex. This is what I was alluding to earlier. There are a lot of parents, a lot of them are mothers, but parents in general, that really use the notion of rights and choice to talk about how their kids need to stay in institutions. I want to say that we have to think about this structurally. Choice became a prominent idea. Choice is not a neutral term. It became a prominent idea in a neoliberal context. At the same time that resources to housing, welfare, healthcare were eroding. So people are made to fight over intentionally depleting resources. Constructing services based on a market economy through this idea of choice, in theory, means that people with disabilities and their family would be able to select the best course of action for the person. And this is what in disability worlds is called the continuum. The continuum approach means that people with disabilities should be able to live in less restrictive setting and more restrictive settings. So for people with high needs, they would be able to be in institutions. For people who have lesser needs, they should live in community or can live in community, in the community with supports. And in between, there's like nursing homes and boarding homes and group homes and all of those things. So this is the idea, and this has been a policy in the disability world since the 60s. It's called the continuum, or the less restrictive environment, if you ever encounter that. So the problem with that approach is that it validates incarceration as a morally valid choice. It's just one choice out of many. You can either incarcerate somebody, or they can live, you know, in the community, and you choose, as if it's a choice at all, especially when living in the community with support is not actually given to people as a quote-unquote choice. So I'm not trying at all to vilify parents. I'm just saying that it's a Ponzi scheme. And unfortunately, people use the language of choice. There is no choice. The whole notion of continuing makes it appear as if somehow there is. So what are some lessons